content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. We're going to be starting the Fall 2023 issue, Volume 63, Number 1, It's Revolutionary, Prelude to War. And the first article is from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Program Coordinator, Jessica Pratt. Hey, y'all. I'm so excited for you to read this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine. And the next one, because they go together like quill and ink. If you don't already know, you soon will learn that July 4th, 2026 is the 250th anniversary of America's independence. Wow. Why are we publishing magazines about this time now instead of waiting until 2026? We understand that the Declaration of Independence did not magically appear on July 4th, 1776. Years of debate, protests, and choices led to the colonies' decision to leave the British Empire. And as you'll read in this issue, many of those things happened in North Carolina. You don't have to travel to Boston, New York, or Philadelphia to learn about independence and the American Revolution. Look for it all around the state. Maybe you've heard of the Boston Tea Party. Did you know that a group of women from the Edenton area bravely signed their names in a protest against British taxation that has been called the Edenton Tea Party? And you probably know the Declaration of Independence, but did you know that months earlier, North Carolina became the first colony to officially call for freedom from Britain with the Halifax Resolves? Keep reading to learn more about the experiences of North Carolinians in the years leading up to the American Revolution. There's a photograph of Jessica with the caption, "As we approach the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, there will be many special events and commemorations. At such programs, you might see historical reenactors wearing reproduction clothing, similar to the items I have on here." The next article is the introduction to the issue, It's Revolutionary, Prelude to War, and it's written by Jason Stroud, who is a historian specializing in revolutionary America and the early republic, especially North Carolina. He is assistant professor of history at Greensboro College. This is the first of a special two-part series from Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine on the American Revolution in North Carolina. The series is titled, It's Revolutionary. But as you'll see in this issue alone, the title might have been, It's Complicated. We might like to imagine that the Revolution was a straightforward struggle for liberty on the part of the American colonists. After a number of offenses against their rights, think no taxation without representation, they rose up to defend these rights. Eventually, this struggle, which we might picture as a gentlemanly fight between guys in fancy uniforms and powdered wigs, led to American independence. Formerly colonists in the British Empire, North Carolinians, or at least white males in North Carolina, became citizens of a new state and a new nation. On the surface, this might not be entirely wrong, but as the stories you'll read in this issue suggest, this is only part of the story. This issue covers a period from the mid-1760s, when colonial protests against British policies kicked off, to 1776, when patriots won an important battle at Morris Creek Bridge, and the Provincial Congress ordered North Carolina's delegation to the Continental Congress to seek independence from Great Britain. These were tumultuous times, and regardless of who they were, those who lived through the American Revolution had a lot of important decisions to make. Many of the articles in this issue are about how and why they made those choices, and what the consequences were. As you'll see, the Revolution wasn't as clear-cut as we'd like to think. Mainly, this was because North Carolina entered the Revolutionary era divided, along regional, economic, and ethnic lines. These divisions helped shape how they viewed and responded to the events of the Revolutionary era. For example, Many farmers in western North Carolina had powerful grievances against the colony's elites. When their complaints were ignored, these farmers felt forced to resort to violence. Many of North Carolina's revolutionary leaders actually participated in an expedition led by Royal Governor William Tryon to crush this rebellion, known as the Regulator Movement. Many other North Carolinians had reasons to be skeptical about protests against British tyranny, especially after hostilities broke out. Scottish Highlanders, for example, were recent arrivals in the colony and had few reasons to resist the British. Enslaved North Carolinians understood that many of the fiercest advocates for American liberties were the very people who enslaved them. Cherokee people had witnessed decades of their lands being taken by colonial settlers, so they saw the revolution as an opportunity to turn the tide of expansion. But as you'll see, thousands of North Carolinians actively supported the revolution, and they were willing to fight to ensure that it was successful. Even in the early days, North Carolina was so divided that some of its most important battles weren't fought against the British Army, the infamous Redcoats we associate with the Revolution. Rather, like Moore's Creek, described in exciting detail in this issue, the battles pitted patriots against loyalists, called Tories by North Carolina's revolutionaries. These North Carolinians decided to put their lives on the line fighting against the Revolution. Other North Carolinians had difficult decisions to make. In this issue, you'll learn that enslaved North Carolinians listened intently to the debates among their enslavers about liberty and rights and made their own decisions about how best to secure their own lives and liberties. It was controversial for women to participate in political affairs in the colonial era, yet North Carolina's women were as caught up in the revolution as men, even more so in some instances. Many women in the Edenton area took the lead in a protest against British policies that made news in neighboring colonies and even in England itself. Women helped shape events in their own ways. People everywhere were caught up in events that seemed out of their control. It must have been frightening to witness the turmoil, uncertainty, and the bloodshed of the 1770s. Everything about them was changing. From the Regulator Rebellion in the backcountry to the Battle of Moore's Creek near Wilmington, people weighed what to do in response. It was revolutionary. It was complicated, but above all, it involved thousands of ordinary people who did the best they could to shape the events of the revolution to improve their own lives and those of their families. How and why they made these decisions is the focus of this revolutionary magazine. There's a sidebar article, What's in a Name? Names used for different groups of people during the Revolutionary War years can be confusing. Some names come from political groupings of people with similar understandings. Others were names adopted by a collection of people who believed similarly about a situation. Sometimes the same group was called by more than one name. So for Team Great Britain, there were the Loyalists. Why this name? Remained loyal to Britain. Tories, an English political group favoring direct rule by the monarch. In the colonies, they supported Britain. And Redcoats. Red was the color of British soldiers' uniforms. The term could also apply to British supporters. Team America had the Patriots, who demonstrated patriotism for the new country. Whigs, W-H-I-G-S. In England, the Whigs were a political group favoring parliamentary power. In the colonies, Whigs favored local legislative power. There were the revolutionaries, those revolting against ties with Britain, and there were the rebels, those rebelling against ties with Britain. There's a photograph accompanying the introductory article with a caption, "It's hard to imagine what the land we now call North Carolina might have looked like in the 1700s, at the dawn of the American Revolution." Perhaps this peaceful photograph taken at the Moore's Creek National Battlefield can help us peek into the past and imagine ourselves there. The next article is Living in Colonial North Carolina by Sally Causey Bloom, who is an educator at the North Carolina Museum of History. What was life like for people during colonial times? It is hard to say what life was like for everyone. By 1770, the land we call North Carolina was home to diverse peoples. Geography played a part in everyday life, too. Some areas, like the Albemarle Sound, had been claimed by English settlers for more than 100 years. There, and in the Cape Fear region, access to trade routes offered some white farmers and merchants the opportunity for wealth through the labor of large numbers of enslaved people. Other areas appealed to colonists seeking spaces to create farms, village, and towns. The forests, streams, and hills of the Piedmont that were home to native peoples. These lands became available due to more than 200 years of change brought about by settlers to native people, including enslavement, disease, encroachment, and warfare. While American Indians remained in the colony, many tribal communities struggled to maintain lands and community. Who was here? Around 200,000 people lived in North Carolina in 1765. That grew to 300,000 people in 1776. Where possible, American Indians remained, adapting while sustaining their cultures. In the western region, the Cherokee maintained community, adopting European ways that they found useful while warily noting settlers moving toward their lands. Enslaved people brought here through forced migration found ways to form family and to resist their bondage in many small ways. At times, they escaped to seek freedom. English, Highland Scot, Scots-Irish, German, and African people brought languages, customs, belief, music, and more to this land. People from other colonies and many other countries arrived here too. Becoming North Carolinians was an ongoing process. How did people live? Almost everyone depended on other people or places for some necessities. Most people had access to natural materials like lumber and stone to build homes. They grew or raised most of their own food as well. But some goods like iron, rum, tea, fancy cloth, and other luxuries had to be imported from other places. Governmental and most religious authority came from England. Here are the captions to the articles accompanying the article's photographs. People needed a lot of labor to farm successfully during colonial times. Most families worked to raise food for themselves. To create surplus, extra labor was needed, often in the form of enslaved workers. This detail from a 1751 map by Joshua Fry and Peter Jefferson depicts enslaved workers unloading cargo. North Carolina's exports generally required access to waterways. These Cherokee pots, circa 1776, are on display in the North Carolina Museum of History's exhibit, The Story of North Carolina. They were made in the traditional Cherokee way, hand rolling clay into strips, stacking and coiling them upward, and then blending them together. A smooth stone rubbed over the pots gave them a shiny finish. Carved wooden paddles were used to imprint designs on them. After sun-drying, they were fired in a wood-burning pit. The next article is Hear Ye, Hear Ye, Communication Makes History by Kelly Agon, who is a librarian who works at the State Library of North Carolina's Government and Heritage Library. She manages the library's public services, and she helps researchers of all ages and interests find information about North Carolina. On a typical day, you might find her helping someone research their family history or a special topic in North Carolina history. You might also find her giving a tour to K-12 teachers and students and helping them start their own research projects. She loves sharing North Carolina history. Take a minute to think about how many times and ways you have communicated today. You likely talked in person to friends, classmates, teachers, and family. You may have used a cell phone, a computer, and several apps. We switch between different technologies and ways of communicating all day long, and most of us don't even think about it. Whether it was 1723 or 2023, people have always had the same need and desire to communicate. Let's look at how people communicated during the 1700s. You may have heard the concepts of communication and social media networks. Communication is the act of sharing ideas, information, and feelings. Social media networks are computer-based digital technology that allows people to share thoughts, ideas, personal messages, and information. Networks are patterns in the way people share information. Your school has a communication network. The office communicates with teachers, students, and parents, and each of those groups communicates with its members and to others outside. People in a network communicate in different ways depending on their needs, and networks can also be used to persuade people to do and even buy something. During the 1700s, people created communication networks too, but with a few differences. Most people communicated in person. Many never left their villages or towns, but like today, people came up with efficient and creative methods for communicating and staying connected. Indigenous peoples were the earliest known inhabitants of a place who shared social, cultural, and ancestral ties, especially of a place that was colonized by a now dominant group. Living in what is now the southeastern United States had complex and efficient communication networks established long before white European colonists began to settle in the region. There were many different tribal communities and languages. Unlike Europeans, indigenous peoples of the region did not have a written alphabet. Instead, they used the spoken word along with singing, performance, sign language, drawing, and art forms like beading to share important knowledge and to pass down stories and history. Nonverbal forms of communication like sign language and drawing were especially important for communicating when people didn't speak the same language. Gift-giving rituals formed a crucial part of Native American culture and communication. Both giving and receiving were an honor and bond. And gifts, like wampum, which are purple and white beads made of polished shells strung in strands, belts, or sashes, used by American Indians as ceremonial pledges and ornaments, often accompanied important communications. Wampum were beads made from shells, and some communities wove patterned belts made from wampum. The pattern symbolized stories of important events, interactions, and agreements. People created and gave them to record, remember, and symbolize peaceful communication. Native communities valued peaceful dialogue, especially for activities like negotiating and trade. Information and goods passed between villages and goods and across the region through a well-developed network of paths that had existed for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. You might think of these geographic networks as an information superhighway. Today, many of the main travel routes across North Carolina exist in the same locations. One main path ran from what is now Virginia through the central part of North Carolina and westward. It was known as the Okeechobee Trading Path, or Great Trading Path. Indigenous peoples of the region relied primarily on walking and canoes to travel, trade, and send information. Historians and anthropologists estimate that indigenous people sometimes walked up to 25 miles a day. Communication was similar but also different in the world of the European colonists. Although they had a written form of language, only about half the population could read and write. People shared news at church, in markets, and in social places like coffee houses and taverns. In addition to talking or writing, they used sermons, plays, and music to communicate. News spread by travelers, merchants, messengers on horseback, and on ships. Important news was shared in letters and made its way into newspapers to spread further. News traveled slowly, taking days or even weeks, depending on distance. Travel by horse from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to Williamsburg, Virginia, 290 miles by land, would take about 2 weeks. By ship, the journey took a week. Today, you can drive that route in a car in about 5 hours. We take mail delivery for granted, whether it's email, the U.S. Postal Service, or services like Amazon. In the colonial era, colonists often had to hire someone privately to carry a message, letter, or passage. Government postal service was slow to develop in all 13 colonies and was often inefficient. Massachusetts was the first in the 1630s. The North Carolina Colonial Assembly passed its first postal law in 1755, more than 100 years later. James Davis, who had been hired as the colony's first printer in 1749, became its first postmaster. Postal officials like Davis were often printers, merchants, or tavern operators. Today, like then, the government postal service is just one part of a network of mail delivery. Like members of indigenous communities, colonists stayed connected through travel and migration, which is a long journey to a new home, often from one country to another, sometimes temporary, but often permanent. North Carolina's colonial population grew slowly until about 1735, and the colony lacked good roads and safe harbors. Still, colonists sent news with travelers, messengers on ferry boats, and riders on horseback. Ferry boats traveling the colony's rivers and creeks brought information to the interior. Communication networks grew as people settled farther west, coming from colonies to the north along the Great Wagon Road. Moravians in Forsyth County used the wagon road to begin sending letters to family and communities as far away as Europe. The Great Wagon Road, which was very rough and not like a modern roadway, developed from sections of the Great Trading Path forged by American Indians over centuries. Colonial communication technology was straightforward: paper and ink and the printing press. Today we can buy paper and pens cheaply in any grocery store. We make most paper from trees. But during the colonial era, paper was expensive, in short supply, and made from used cotton and linen rags, and even old ship sails. Sounds like recycling, right? By the time of the French and Indian War, which ran from 1754 to 1763, colonists were producing paper, and printing was in full swing by private citizens. The number of newspapers in the colonies had grown to about 37 by 1755. Broadsides, like posters on bulletin boards, were everywhere, and political cartoons were appearing in newspapers. Pamphlets printed information on everything from agriculture and weather to religion and, of course, politics. The French and Indian War and the Stamp Act, which was a new tax passed by the British Parliament in 1765 that required all American colonists to pay a tax on printed materials, ships' papers, newspapers, legal documents, and even playing cards. Stamps issued by Britain were placed on these items to show the tax had been paid. So the French and Indian War and the Stamp Act were catalysts for increasing colonial opposition to English laws and taxes. Activists used newspapers and pamphlets as a cheap way to fight a war with words. Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine were two of the most famous pamphleteers. North Carolina also had a pamphleteer, Herman Husband, who organized protests, spoke out, and wrote about colonial government corruption beginning in 1766. Corruption is dishonest or illegal behavior, especially by powerful people or the government. Husband even went to jail for political organizing and writing. Franklin printed one of the first political cartoons in a colonial newspaper in 1754 with "Join or Die." Like an internet cartoon going viral, it quickly circulated in colonial papers in Pennsylvania, New York, and Massachusetts, then Virginia and South Carolina. Look at the image of the fatal stamp. First published in March 1765 in Philadelphia, it mocked the government tax stamp. The fatal stamp soon appeared in papers across the colonies and in New Bern's North Carolina Gazette several months later. People in the colonies would have known exactly what these symbolic images meant. Technology and networks helped them share these messages. There's a sidebar here that shows, this picture shows Benjamin Franklin's political cartoon, Join or Die. It was published with the editorial in the Pennsylvania Gazette on May 9, 1754. It is one of the most famous political cartoons in history. It shows a snake cut into pieces, and each piece has a state's abbreviation next to it. Can you find North Carolina included in the image? How many colonies do you see here? Why do you think some colonies are missing? American colonists engaged in protesting and advocating for their own liberty, but colonial society denied the benefits of freedom to enslaved persons. Some colonies even passed laws forbidding enslaved people to read and write. Despite this, enslaved people developed their own creative ways for self-expression and sharing coded information across fields, plantation, and even farther away. Enslaved people used singing, especially a style called call and response. Call and response is a musical style in which the first and often solo part is answered by a second and often ensemble part. In parts of Africa, often used in democratic discussions and religious gatherings, and brought to the American colonies by enslaved Africans. Call and response was used to share stories and information. They also shared information and held on to their own culture by retelling and creating folk tales filled with symbols and metaphors. Enslaved people also used forms of communication and self-expression like storytelling and singing to resist enslavement. And later, during the 1800s, to send messages along the escape network known as the Underground Railroad. Now it's your turn. How will you share what you have learned about communication in the 1700s with your network of family, friends, and classmates? Here are the captions for the photographs. Have you ever heard the saying, a picture is worth a thousand words? Based on what you know so far, what do you think this picture is of a skull and crossbones? This copy of the original fatal stamp was published in New Bern's North Carolina Gazette on November 20, 1765, after colonial protests to the Stamp Act started heating up. Would you be surprised if you saw this advertisement in a newspaper today? Rags were a valuable item for printers and paper manufacturers in the 1700s, and they often advertised to buy them. This advertisement appeared in the New Bern's newspaper, the North Carolina Gazette, on December 19, 1787. It reads, rags, a good price will be given for clean linen and cotton rags by the printer himself. Also, a painting of Benjamin Franklin from 1778, and Benjamin Franklin's press in his printing house, now a museum in Philadelphia. This is where Franklin, one of America's founding fathers, published the Pennsylvania Gazette, the most successful newspaper in Britain's American colonies. A map of American Indian trading paths in North Carolina, probable routes, based on information from the 42nd Annual Report of the Bureau of American Ethnology to the Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, 1924-1925, and wampum, were beads made from shells used in gift-giving rituals. These modern wampum are being strung to make a belt. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.